She was a charming middle-aged lady with a face like a bucket of mud. I gave her a drink. She was a gal who'd take a drink if she had to knock you down to get the bottle.
I expect you to behave in all ways like a civilized human being. First it's Tiger's boyish charm, and now it's your indefinable something.
Poor nice Albert.
I am nice. Wouldn't you think she'd notice?
The bottom is loaded with nice people, Albert. Only cream and bastards rise.
Hello and welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast 43, the movie podcast that requires a Bosky, a Jim Brown, a Miss Daisy, two Jethros and a Leon Spinks, not to mention the biggest Ella Fitzgerald ever. My name is Terry Frost and this time around I'm looking at dicks. Not John Holmes, Dirk Diggler, throbbing one-eyed pythons of love dicks, but private dicks, gumshoes, inquiry agents, private eyes. The movies I'm looking at this time are Murder, My Sweet from 1944, Harper from 1946, and The Long Goodbye from 1971. How are you people? I know a lot of you are freezing and it's getting very, very like a Dean Emmerich movie on your half of the planet, but here it's around 100 degrees Fahrenheit, about 36, 38 centigrade, sunny, the cat's laying in the shade, totally opposite to the problems they're having in the UK and in Europe. So everyone stay warm and stay safe. Hopefully the Gulf Stream will reassert itself in its proper course. And you can stop pretending that you're in a very bad disaster movie. So yeah, what have I been watching lately? I'm going to talk about the movies in a minute, but I'll kind of do the mail and do the update on what I've been watching first. I saw Sherlock Holmes, the Guy Ritchie movie, and to be really fair, I think the guy's back on course since he divorced Madge, or she divorced him, whichever way around. Yeah, it's not a bad little movie. I'm not too sure how it fits into the Sherlock Holmes canon. I do think as a standalone film, but it holds its own. It's got that beautiful Victorian, kind of slightly steampunkish look about it. Robert Downey Jr. is always interesting in a way that only Robert Downey Jr. can be. Jude Law's pretty well okay now that he's got past that stage of being a pretty boy. He may well turn out to be a reasonable actor. What else have I watched? I did see a good science fiction movie, so for all of my friends who are big science fiction buffs like me, good one. It's called Time Crimes. I think it's like Chrono Criminalis or something like that in Spanish. It's a Spanish movie. Not an enormous budget, but a good little time travel movie. I won't go too far into it because it may lead towards spoilers, but I know it's turned up on the World Movies Channel here in Australia, and I'm sure it's available on Netflix over in the US and by other means in the UK and in Europe and in Asia and in Africa and all those other places in South America and Canada and Mexico and all those other places where people listen to the podcast. And, of course, New Zealand. Good, tight script, stays true to the premise without fudging the time travel aspect of it. And for people who like that sort of thing and who doesn't, there is a little bit of nudity as well. I'm not even sure if it's gratuitous. I think, actually, they've integrated it into the plot line in a way I haven't really seen before. But I recommend that one. Watched a number of old movies as well. Nothing that really leaps out to mind. I'm going to have to take better notes on what I'm watching. I know that the guys over at Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema are always listing vast lists of these fantastic movies that they're watching, but being a disorganized person as I am, I haven't got around to that. Maybe I really do have to make the effort so I can throw a few more recommendations than just the movies that I'm discussing in detail in the podcast. I can throw those at you. So, yeah, weather's been fine. New Year's Eve, had a great time, caught up with some people at a party. We got this enormous thunderstorm through about 9 p.m. It was a stinking hot, humid day all day. And then an enormous black cloud and thunder and lightning and rain and all sorts of things coming through, which made it a slightly more memorable than usual New Year's Eve. But enjoyed it, caught up with some people, talked movies with a few people, talked a number of other things, and just in general enjoyed myself. Sal was looking after her parents at the time. I picked her up a day or two later, so we kind of went up for a parting of the ways for a very, very short time, of course. But yeah, it was a good time. Not much else to talk about there. Of course, Avatar's now gone to 1 billion plus, being the second most popular James Cameron movie in history so far, of course, making it the second most popular movie in dollar terms in the world. I'm not sure why. I mean, I think the technology may be the kicking point there, and maybe Cameron's ability to make a phenomenon as much as a movie, even though his movies are flawed in a number of aspects, they do seem to rake the punters in, of course, me being one of them. Yeah, well, hopefully the 3D technology will eventually kick through to something a bit more interesting. We did get some emails, so thank you very much, everybody. I think having a question that needed answering as a part of the last podcast is an approach that works. So thank you very much for your attention and your time. I'll just go into the letters after a little bit of a sting and talk about what you guys want me to talk about.
Hay un bailecito, el de cha cha cha. Ay, qué sabrosito, bombo camara. Con ese pasillo se puede gozar como en Manzanillo. Lo puede bailar.
There you go. I just thought I'd throw a little bit of cha-cha-cha at you just to liven things up a little bit. First letter we got was from Fossil John over in Aotearoa, the land that we Pakehas know as New Zealand. He sent me a letter saying, "Hi, Terry, look forward to the podcast each time. I flesh out the intervening weeks with GGTMC, Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema, and Tin Stroker versus Punter out of the UK. All these casts offer something a little different. Suggestions? I don't know anyone else who would cover Walkabout by Nick Rogue and Emerald Forest by John Borman, both movies that match visual style to an equal measure with thematic content. We'll be interested to see what you think. Have a great summer and hopefully some time off with Sal from Fossil John in New Zealand." Yeah, hi Fossil John. Both are great suggestions for Listener's Choice podcast, but I'm going to go with Walkabout for a couple of reasons. A, I have a copy of it, which always is a good thing. B, The Emerald Forest is from 1985, which is outside the paleo cinema kind of self-imposed ambit. And C, I can look at Walkabout from the viewpoint of someone who's visited the outback, lived in the country town for a while, and I've driven across Australia twice and I was born here. So in short, I've got more to bring to Walkabout rather than The Emerald Forest. The other cast you listen to are a good recommendation for people. People occasionally drop me lines on Facebook and Twitter saying, which podcast do you listen to? What do you recommend? GTTMC, definitely there. I like their stuff. And Chinstroker versus Punter. I did listen to a few of those episodes now. Still debating whether I'll continue to do so. I kind of disagree with Paul from Chinstroker versus Punter a little too much. I'm going to give it another go. But I think Paul's kind of narrow viewpoint puts me off a little bit. But that's very personal. They're very good at what they're doing. They're very articulate. What they're saying is often very interesting. But it comes down to personal taste. We'll see how we go with that. But I recommend anybody try out any podcast that gets recommended to you. Just download an episode or two. See whether it's to your particular style or not. And basically filter down the things that you enjoy listening to. So next email, Rickster, who's also known as Serps, he's got a couple of pseudonyms there, threw some kilobytes of data my way. He said, "Hola, Terry. Enjoyed the latest podcast on wheels. What a nice way to shake things up at the end of the year. While you may have sacrificed a little of the usual Terry Frost in-depth film analysis, the novelty of a podcast directly from the freeway made up for it. I also like how you tied in this latest podcast with your very first 2 weeks in another town, harking back to your very first podcast and The Bad and the Beautiful. Nice circularity, cowboy. And I suppose I'd like to pick up the gauntlet you hurled down by requesting the classic Dick Powell film noir, Murder My Sweet, to get the Terry Frost once over. Superlative podcast as always, and Sal's holiday greeting was priceless. A fan for life, Rickster, a.k.a. Serps." Thanks, Rickster, for proving Carl Gustav Jung's concept of synchronicity. I was planning to do this podcast on Private Eye movies anyway, and Murder My Sweet was on the list, along with the other two that I'm talking about, Harper and Long Goodbye. 2 days after I wrote the list, your email arrived. So shallow minds think alike, mate. As for Sal's greeting, you wouldn't believe the flaming hoops I have to jump through sometimes to get her to record them. She gets a little mic shy at times, but always ends up delivering an amusing product. So thanks for the recommendations. The Murder My Sweet, of course, is going to this podcast, not the Listener's Choice podcast next time around, but one way or the other, it's happening. So next up, I've got one from Kyle Nip up in the Pacific Northwest. Hi, Terry. I was thinking about your request for suggestions for your future podcast, and I have a few films that I would think will be worth a discussion. Grand Prix, directed by John Frankenheimer. I know you just did your podcast dedicated to Mr. Frankenheimer. I know it's not subversive as the films discussed in the Paranoia trilogy, but I do love the cinematography in this film. Second recommendation, Night of the Hunter, directed by Charles Laughton. I know it's a darling for film buffs like myself, but it's a film I still think is overlooked when compared to films like Cape Fear. Plus, it's one of my favourite bad guy roles for Robert Mitchum. Third recommendation, Salo, or The 120 Days of Sodom, directed by Piers Pablo Pasolini. Okay, this is a more of an honourable mention than anything, but me and a fellow cult film buff rented a bootleg copy of this film almost 20 years ago, and to this day I'm scared. I even have the Criterion DVD of this film, but I can't muster the courage to actually watch the thing. Thanks, Kyle. Good recommendations. Grand Prix, which we used to pronounce as Grand Prix when I was a kid. Might be good to visit at some stage. I'll look it over and I'll think about it. I think it was also produced in Cinerama, you know, the extremely widescreen format. I wouldn't mind seeing that in a Cinerama theatre. I don't think they have them in Australia anymore. They did have one in Sydney when I was a kid. Maybe two. But, of course, Cinerama being one of those formats that fell by the wayside, may be a little difficult to get around to. But I kind of like that very widescreen format. Like I like any kind of technology that expands the possibilities of film. Okay, Night of the Hunter. Yeah, I'll go for that one in the listener's choice. Lawton's only movie as a director. Mitchum, Lillian Gish, Shelley Winters. Lots of stuff I can do with that. As for Salo, it didn't do a lot for me. But then I'm not much into coprophagy, which any aficionado of perversion knows is eating shit. And by shit, I don't mean McDonald's. I think shocking people's good, but you've got to have a purpose with it. And Salo's shock obscures rather than illuminates the points that Pasolini was trying to make, whatever they were. Watch it, but don't expect to enjoy it too much. I think it's not among my favourites. It's never going to be The Bad and the Beautiful for me. Okay? Now, we also got some negative criticism, which I will cop on the chin in this case. It's from Mike Ryan in my native homeland of Sydney, New South Wales, Australia. Dear Terry, thanks for the enjoyment provided over your series of podcasts. I switched off the mobile version after 12 minutes. Sorry. The sound quality was appalling. Hope this experiment comes to an end now. Best to you and Sal for the new year, Mike. Mike, I will take the criticism. The sound quality wasn't up to it, and I'm going to give you a little bit of a tech geek explanation for it, because the raw audio was actually quite good. The raw audio from the headset and my portable podcasting gear, the Belkin Go Studio that I used to hook up to my iPod to record the audio, came out well. Problem was, I ran the audio, and because different mics record things slightly differently, I ran it through the normal software I use for leveling out the sound levels across the podcast. It's a piece of freeware called Levelator. And what I didn't do was quality check it as much as I should have. And Levelator actually lifted the background noise levels as well as lifting the levels of the audio. Normally, you can adjust for that by leveling it out manually across the little readouts. But in this case, I didn't, and I will cop that on the chin, and it's a fair call. I'm glad you enjoyed the rest of the podcast, and if I fuck up again, please tell me. Anybody. If I make a mistake or there's something you didn't like, tell me. I'm not chicken of that kind of thing. Always useful feedback, so please keep listening, Mike, and I'll make every effort to ensure that the quality control is up to what it should be. Okay, Troy Date. I recommend Troy's site, troydate.com, if you need any graphic design work done. Troy says, hi, Terry. Hope the new year is treating you well instead of beating you to hell. My idea of hell would be to tied up in a theatre seat a la Clockwork Orange and being forced to watch Independence Day over and over again. Good thing I don't believe in hell. I would really enjoy hearing your input on the brilliant 1941 movie Sullivan's Travels. And that's one of his recommendations. How about doing a show where you dissect all the metadata in Inglourious Basterds? I know I'm probably not getting half the nods that you would, and I'd like to know what films Quentin was referencing. Cheers, Troy Date. That would be a job. Inglourious Basterds, I've watched it once. I'm holding off watching it the second time. I do have a copy on disc, but I'm holding off watching it until I can, you know, really get the snack foods and maybe a beer or two ready and just kind of sit down and enjoy it. After I got the email, Troy, I did think through and I did pick up on a couple of references that even I didn't get the first time around just by remembering the movie. So there are a few things that are referenced by Quentin, as usual. And as for doing a podcast about it, it's going to be a major project. And of course, I'm going to miss out a whole bunch of different things that are in the film because everybody's got a different knowledge of film. So mine's not as encyclopedic as Quentin's, but I suppose there are times in his life when he's got a lot more time to watch movies than I do. Yeah, I mean, I can, when I do watch it, here's what I'll do. When I do watch it, I'll do some bullet points on a bunch of the references I got while I was watching it. I don't mind doing that for you guys. Don't know how many of you will be interested, but I'll do it. And I'll make it a section of one of the podcasts. I'm not sure I can dedicate a whole podcast to it. It is about a modern movie, but I suppose given the fact that the movie references that it reflects are old in a lot of cases, then I can probably get away with it without totally selling my pretension that this is about old movies. Great recommendation. When I do watch it, I will sit down with my little notepad or my, in this case, probably my netbook laptop, and I'll reference it and make it a section of a podcast. So can't ask for better than that. And I can get a copy of Sullivan's Travels to look at. I did watch it on cable a while back, and yep, I enjoyed it. Don't know whether anybody knows this, but Sullivan's Travels is a movie that gave the Coen brothers a title for their movie, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? But anyway, I will locate it, I will watch it, and that's the third movie for next podcast, which is a Listener's Choice podcast. So going back over them, the first one I'm going to take a look at, in no particular order, they're going to be Sullivan's Travels, Walkabout, and Night of the Hunter. Thematically, nothing to do with each other. I can't link them in the way I am with this podcast and the Private Eye movies. Doesn't matter. It's what you guys want to hear about. So we'll go with that. Now, that's about it for the emails I got. I did get a whole bunch of comments on Twitter and Facebook, or if you're Italian, Facebook. They're kind of a little hard to put in there, but I'll answer those ones individually. So I'll get a Facebook comment. I'll answer it on Facebook in the public part of my Facebook profile. If I get one on Twitter, I'll answer it on Twitter. It's a little easier than having these little epigrammatic bits to read out on the podcast. So we'll expand the podcast comment section slightly into those two social media. So I'm going to take another break and then I'll actually start talking about the movies. Okay, let's get on to the Private Eye movies. I'm going to read you a little bit from an essay Raymond Chandler wrote called The Simple Art of Murder, and it describes what a private eye should be in a private eye thing. So if you hear pages rustling, I'm reading it out of a slightly antiquated paperback. Okay, the detective in this kind of story must be a man, must be such a man. He is a hero, he is everything. He must be a complete man and a common man and yet an unusual man. He must be, to use a rather weathered phrase, a man of honour, by instinct, by inevitability, without thought of it, and certainly without saying it. He must be the best man in his world and a good enough man for any world. I do not care much about his private life. He is neither a eunuch nor a satyr. I think he might seduce a duchess, and I'm quite sure he would not spoil a virgin. If he is a man of honour in one thing, he is that in all things. He is a relatively poor man, or he would not be a detective at all. He is a common man, or he could not go among common people. He has a sense of character, or he would not know his job. He will take no man's money dishonestly, and no man's insolence without a due and dispassionate revenge. He is a lonely man, and his pride is that you will treat him as a proud man, or be very sorry you ever saw him. He talks as a man of his age talks, that is, with rude wit, a lively sense of the grotesque, a disgust for sham, and a contempt for pettiness. So that's Raymond Chandler talking about Private Eyes, and of course, by association, his Private Eye, Philip Marlowe. Now, Marlowe's been in a number of movies in a number of different guises over a very long time. Originally, in the first film incarnation of Philip Marlowe, he wasn't even called Philip Marlowe. The first film adaptation was in 1942, and it starred George Sanders, and the movie was called The Falcon Takes Over. They substituted the Falcon, the detective George Sanders was playing in a series of movies, for Philip Marlowe, but it was still an adaptation of Farewell, My Lovely. Second time, he didn't get the name either. It was Mike Shane with Lloyd Nolan playing Mike Shane. It was a movie called A Time to Kill in 1942, an adaptation of Chandler's The High Window. The first time it appeared in the Philip Marlowe appeared as Philip Marlowe in a movie was this one, 1944, Murder, My Sweet, which again was an adaptation of Farewell, My Lovely, with Dick Powell as Marlowe. Of course, you then go on to the more famous ones, The Big Sleep with Bogart as Marlowe, Lady in the Lake with Robert Montgomery as Marlowe. Lady in the Lake's a particularly interesting film because it's all done from first-person viewpoint. So basically the camera is Philip Marlowe and you only ever see him reflected in mirrors and things like that. It's an incredibly interesting film for that point of view. The whole film is done looking through Philip Marlowe's eyes. There was The Brasher Doubloon in 1947, which was another adaptation of The High Window starring George Montgomery. 1969, you got Marlowe with James Garner and featuring a very cool scene with Bruce Lee kicking the shit out of an apartment, I think it was. I'm not sure. I haven't seen the movie in a long time. I haven't been able to pick up a copy of Marlowe at this stage. Of course, you got The Long Goodbye, which is one of the other films I'm talking about today with Elliot Gould. Farewell, My Lovely with Mitchum in 1975. And The Big Sleep in 1978, which was made in England, I believe, with, again, Mitchum as Philip Marlowe. There have been a lot of radio adaptations. Dick Powell did it in 44. He did Murder, My Sweet as an adaptation of the film for radio. Van Heflin played him in 1947 in a radio series called New Adventures of Philip Marlowe. In Suspense, you got a cameo by the series host Robert Montgomery. There was a crossover between Sam Spade and Philip Marlowe in that radio show in 1948. Lux Radio Theatre, Lady in the Lake was adapted with Robert Montgomery. We got Dick Powell again. Gerald Moore, who you might remember from Angry Red Planet. Dick Powell did it in 54 again. Philip Carey played him in the Philip Marlowe TV series in 1959-1960. Powers Booth played him in a 1980s TV version. Ed Bishop played him on a radio for BBC in 1988. Danny Glover played Philip Marlowe on Showtime television in the adaptation of Red Wind. And Poodle Springs with James Caan was adapted from a fragment of Chandler's work, which was completed by Robert B. Parker. So, you know, Philip Marlowe's had a long history in cinema and TV and radio. I'm actually surprised it's not a computer game. But we're going to go back to the original one, which is Dick Powell. Dick Powell's an interesting actor. He started out being like a light hoofer and song and dance man. You might remember him from 42nd Street. And he kind of headed into around about his 40th birthday. And RKO wanted him for a bunch of light films, like comedy, musical type films. RKO was having a bit of trouble at the time. Howard Hughes was running it, and the finances weren't doing terrifically well. So Dick Powell had a bit of leverage there. So what he said was, yeah, I'll do a few films for you, but you've got to give me a serious role to do first. I want to do a dramatic role. I want to kind of break out of this kind of light actor, hoofer, singer kind of deal and do something a bit interesting. And the thing that he ended up doing was an adaptation of Farewell, My Lovely, called Murder, My Sweet. The reason they didn't call it Farewell, My Lovely was, if they had have titled it Farewell, My Lovely, people would have thought it was a Dick Powell musical. So putting the Murder, My Sweet bit in there actually gave it the edge that it needed for people not to go into the movie expecting chorus girls in short skirts and ending up with Mike Mazurki beating people up. So I'm going to play another little soundbite. I played one right at the start of the podcast, but I'm going to play another little soundbite of Philip Marlowe. This time around, he's been drugged by a kind of quack doctor and held incommunicado for 3 days. And this is part of the hallucinogenic nightmares, which is done incredibly surrealistically in the film. It's fantastic. There are like a series of doors that keep opening up, and each door is smaller. You get him walking down a flight of stairs and the stair railing disappears. It's very freaky and surrealistic and done very well given the technologies and the budgetary limitations of the time. But I'll play that for you and come back and talk a little more about the film.
The black pool opened up at my feet again and I dived in. Next thing I remember, I was going somewhere. It was not my idea. The rest of it was a crazy, coked-up dream. I had never been there before.
I'll do a little bit of a plot précis for this one. There's not a hell of a lot there, but what there is choice. Detective Philip Marlowe, Dick Powell, is hired by hulking Moose Malloy, Mike Mazurki, to locate his girlfriend, Velma, that he lost track of while serving time in prison. With each lead he follows, Marlowe encounters lies, larceny, perjury, theft, and a beautiful femme fatale played by Claire Trevor. Now, this film is terrific, and the reason it's terrific, the main thing, and this is the best example I've got of this, is the voiceover narration by Dick Powell. Voiceover narration can be used well or can be used badly. I mean, Blade Runner, not so good. Murder, My Sweet, it's used perfectly. It's got Chandler's narrative voice in it. It's got the cynicism, Chandler's fantastic use of simile. You know, like there was a dame to make a bishop kick a hole in a plate glass window, that kind of stuff. Dick Powell puts it across incredibly well. He has that light cynicism, but there's a slight edge when there needs to be, as you got from that clip. One of the things about Philip Marlowe is he pretends to be less than he is in order to solve the crime, and you'll see this particularly in the Elliot Gould adaptation in The Long Goodbye. He basically plays the clown slightly and uses that sardonic humour and that ability to bounce back, that resilience that the Philip Marlowe character has of necessity. You get hit on the head a few times, you got to bounce back or you're in hospital. But that kind of ability to let other people underestimate him is one of the nice things about the Dick Powell character in this film. And he brings across, for the first time in any of the other adaptations, it was just the generic plot line they pinched from Chandler's novel. But this time around, they have that bit that Chandler mentioned about him having that sense of honour and that sense of duty to follow through and see that some form of justice does prevail. And Dick Powell does this very, very well. It would have been nice to see a series of Dick Powell, Philip Marlowe movies where they covered the Chandler novels. I mean, he could have done well into his 50s, into the times later in his career when he was doing the Dick Powell show, and he brought a lot of good drama to television in the 50s as an actor and as a director. The whole point of Murder, My Sweet is that wonderful narrative voice, that ability to see that the cops are pretty stupid in a way, that they're following through on the case and things like that, but they just don't know the deceptions that are confusing them. They don't understand things the way that Marlowe does. They can't see through some of the other characters to the extent that Marlowe ultimately does. Now, the femme fatale Helen Grail, played by Claire Trevor, isn't the interesting female character in the film. The interesting female character is an actress called Anne Shirley playing Anne Grail, who, Helen Grail is the second wife of Anne's father, played by Miles Mander. And they're pretty much of a slightly similar age, but Anne Grail is a nice foil for Dick Powell's character. They've got a nice rapport there. They've got that kind of light, playful banter thing happening there. And meanwhile, of course, you've got Mike Mazurki playing Moose Malloy, a great big hulking guy who seems to be a bit surprised when people automatically don't do what he wants them to, and then he has to push them around. He's got that kind of, oh, I've got to do that, do I? Kind of attitude to trying to find where his ex-girlfriend Velma is. And one of the nice things, I mean, Mike Mazurki is, of course, a character actor who was stereotyped. He was a wrestler originally, and he was stereotyped all the way up to his last film role, which was a small cameo with Carrie Fisher in Amazon Women on the Moon, of all things. And that's quite a funny bit of the movie, actually. But Mike Mazurki actually brings a little poignancy to the end, to the last bits of Moose Malloy being in the film, which I kind of liked. He's not bright. He might be a bit punch drunk. He's a great big hulking brute of a guy, but there's a certain weird kind of integrity to him, which brings the character slightly out of the two-dimensional thug thing. Watch for that towards the end of the film. And, of course, the movie ends with a nice cute bit between Anne Shirley and Dick Powell where they, it's not giving anything away in this kind of film to say they kiss in a taxi cab, but I won't let you know the context in which they do. But I do like this film. I saw it for the first time not too long ago. I'd heard a lot about it. I'd seen little clips in various documentaries about film noir, but I really like it. It's one of my favourite 40s crime movies now. And one of the other things you should watch for in the film is the use of lighting. It's right at the start of film noir, 20 years before the French guys thought up the name for that, or not quite 20, but 16 years before the guys thought that up. That beautiful black and white lighting with the deep shadows and the long shadows used almost as an architectural decoration in various scenes. Watch for the bits where Philip Marlowe is hallucinating. They're done very well for the time. It's one of those things that they didn't have to do that well for a movie. It was a programmer. It was an A movie for RKO, which was a minor studio, but there's an artistry to this one that you didn't sometimes get in some other films. And definitely put it on your list. It's one to watch. So that's about all I've got to say about the film. I don't want to go into too much in case I spoil it for you, but if you haven't seen it, pick it up. Locate it, enjoy it. Now I'm going to take another break, and then I'm going to talk about Harper, 1966 movie starring Paul Newman, Lauren Bacall, Julie Harris, Arthur Hill, Janet Leigh, Pamela Tiffin, Robert Wagner, Robert Webber, Shelley Winters, Harold Gould, with music by Johnny Mandel and directed by Jack Smite. Though, to be really fair here, I've got to mention something about Murder, My Sweet, which I totally neglected to mention. It was directed by Edward Dimitrik, and an incredibly good job of directing he did. The movie paces well. There's always something interesting happening. There's not a bit of slack in it. And as I said, recommended. Before I go to talk about Harper, I'm going to tell you how I found out about this movie. It goes back to the 80s. I was a science fiction fan. I have been for a long time, as a lot of you know. And I was at a convention up in the Blue Mountains west of Sydney, right at the top of a mountain, a place called Medlow Bath. And, you know, the whole point of these conventions at this time was to get a whole bunch of people together and drink a lot. And the conventions they had up at Medlow Bath were kind of like that. And I was sitting around, we were shooting the shoot in a hotel room, and with us was a writer, a guy called Lee Harding, who'd written a whole bunch of very good young adult science fiction novels. A book called Displaced Person in particular is fantastic. And we started talking movies, apart from, you know, we occasionally sang old show tunes together, and we're talking about movies. And he recommended Harper to me because he'd just seen it on TV, and he was blown away by it. This is before anybody knew much about William Goldman. This is before Adventures in the Screen Trade was really big. Might have even been, wouldn't have been the late 70s, it would have been the early 80s. And Lee was quoting these whole swathes of dialogue from this Paul Newman detective movie that he'd seen. He said, "You've got to find this movie, you've got to see it, it's fantastic." And now this was slightly before VHS came, really hit big. So you'd have to wait around till something appeared on television. And on his recommendation I did, and yeah, I liked it. So that's how I found out about Harper originally. It was recommended to me by a writer. The thing is, the weird thing about it is that the dialogue he quoted to me sticks in my memory today. The movie was based on one of the Lou Archer novels by Ross McDonald, and the screenplay was written by William Goldman. Now, if you don't know who William Goldman is, then you probably should find out. If you don't have a copy of William Goldman's Adventures in the Screen Trade or his second book about writing for movies, What Lie Did I Tell, then you should get them. I have two copies of Adventures in the Screen Trade, an older one that I use as a referencing, and somebody gave me one again last year for my birthday, which shows the high regard my movie buff friends hold this movie in, William Goldman in. If you don't know him, I'll give you a bit of an idea about his credits. He wrote, apart from Harper, which was his second screenplay after a movie called Masquerade starring Cliff Robertson, he did No Way to Treat a Lady. He wrote Butch Cassidy and a Sundance Kid. He wrote the original Stepford Wives. He wrote All the President's Men, Marathon Man, A Bridge Too Far, Magic, The Princess Bride. He did the screenplay for Misery, Ghost in the Darkness, the movie of Maverick, the screenplay for Chaplin starring Robert Downey Jr. from 1992. Absolute Power, Fierce Creatures, Dreamcatcher, Hearts in Atlantis. The guy's got credit there. And he does talk a lot about Harper. He has a whole chapter dedicated to Harper in Adventures in the Screen Trade. So I'm going to crib a little bit from that. Making the movie was originally Goldman's idea, according to Goldman. He was talking to Elliot Kasner, who was the producer for Harper, and suggested that Kasner look at some of Ross McDonald's Lou Archer novels. Harper came along later on because Paul Newman had a thing about names starting with H because he'd made a number of successful movies where the titled character's name was the movie HUD, that kind of thing. And they changed it to Harper at that recommendation. Now, one of the interesting things is there's a title sequence in this film, which I won't spoil for you. But originally, the shooting script that William Goldman had for the movie started with him turning up at the big mansion owned by the millionaires that hire him. And Goldman, after he submitted the script, got a phone call from the producers saying, "Hey, we need something to put over the title sequence." So they created a title sequence with Lou Harper getting up in the morning and going to work, essentially. And one of the interesting things about it was that title sequence sold the film. The character, they knew who the character was, what he was about, what his circumstances were, what kind of person he was, based on a totally undialogued title sequence to this movie. And that's one of those lessons that people who write screenplays learn. You've got to get people engaged with the character right from the start, and pretty much the go-to example is the pre-title sequence in Harper. The plot for the movie is pretty simple. Lou Harper is hired by a millionaire heiress to find her kidnapped husband, the heiress in this case being played by Lauren Bacall. Now, one of the interesting things that this movie you see about 5 minutes in is that Lauren Bacall is in a wheelchair being tanned by some sun lamps. And the nice conceit here is, if you have a look at The Big Sleep, her father was sitting in a wheelchair when he hired Philip Marlowe to find whatever it was, I forgot, from Big Sleep that was going missing. So it's kind of like a little bit of an homage to The Big Sleep to have Lauren Bacall in the role played by the actor playing her father in The Big Sleep. So there's a little bit of a twist there. And I'll just play a little bit from the interview that Lauren Bacall's character has with Lou Harper.
Mrs. Sampson?
That's right.
Lou Harper. Albert Graves' telephone said you needed me for something.
Oh. A drink, Mr. Harper?
Not before lunch, thanks.
I thought you were a detective.
New type.
Oh. Albert Graves is one of our lawyers. It's on his recommendation I'm hiring you.
It's about time he threw some business my way.
Hmm?
I've known Albert since he was DA up here.
Oh, he said you were good at finding things. My husband's a... You're sitting on my robe. My husband's disappeared.
Tried missing persons?
Well, that might mean publicity. Ralph loathes publicity. Besides, he's got an abnormal fear of the police. I simply want you to find him and tell me which female he's with.
Any particular female?
I haven't the least notion. Ralph need never know about this. He'd be sure I was gathering material for divorce proceedings. Actually, I have no intention of divorcing him. I only intend to outlive him. I only want to see him in his grave. What a terrible thing to say.
People in love will say anything.
So again, like Murder, My Sweet, you've got that cute dialogue, that the wit and the bantering back and forth that kind of illuminates the character of the people involved. In this case, Mrs. Sampson, who Lauren Bacall plays as incredibly bitchy and catty. In fact, there are a couple of cat references in what she says to kind of enhance that perception of her as a cat who has the cream. So there are another number of other characters. There's her husband's pilot, played by Robert Wagner, in his cute playboy mold. But he breaks out of that later in the film. You find out that there's a depth of the character that's not immediately apparent. There's her stepdaughter, played by Pamela Tiffin, who's kind of not a Lolita, but a young, sexy, cute thing, rich, you know, kind of like a proto Paris Hilton kind of rich girl, but maybe with a little bit more of a brain than Paris Hilton. And there's Strother Martin in this film, playing a kind of new age guru living on top of a mountain. You've got Robert Webber playing a gunman, Shelley Winters playing a fading actress. Julie Harris playing a jazz singer, and she's got a few good scenes in there as well. Overall, this film, I mean, it goes a little bit deeper too. There are some moral ambiguities, particularly in the end of the film, which is one of the things that first drew me to the film when I first heard about it, was that there's an ambiguous ending to the film, which I kind of like. The moral compass is spinning a little bit. I won't spoil it, but what I'm saying is that there's a decision needs to be made that's made by two people at the same time, and makes for a quite interesting ending to a film. The movie is not an unsatisfying ending at all. In fact, it's very satisfying. It's thematically complete. There's no, apart from Lou Harper himself, there aren't any really morally unambiguous characters in the whole thing. I mean, he is the best man in his world, the way Chandler said that Private Eye should be. And one of the other nice things about it is that this film kind of did a resurgence in Private Eye movies. From about the early 50s onwards, Private Eyes were seen on TV more than they were seen on film, particularly large-budget Hollywood studio films. And one of the things that Harper the movie did was bring back that sense of fun, that sense that it was slightly nostalgic but updated as well. That sense that Private Eye films did have the ability to be box office. and they'd gone from the dark black and white film noir looking chiaroscuro kind of photography of the 1940s and early 1950s to the bright Technicolor film that Jack Smite, the director, made of this one. It's got the bright California sunshine there. And it kind of drew the detective novel, or the detective narrative, in a new direction, the bright, cruel world of modern day, at that stage, California, which I found kind of interesting. The plot isn't that difficult to follow. I mean, like any good Private Eye movie, it's about the characters, it's about the character of the protagonist. Well, actually, there is one other morally unambiguous character in this film, come to think of it. And that's his wife, Susan, played by Janet Leigh. She doesn't like the fact that he's a private eye. They're breaking up. She's trying to get him to sign the divorce papers. And they have a slight reconciliation at one stage. But the rapport between the two actors, too, is fantastic in those scenes. You can get that. They play as if they've got a history between the two people, which is it kind of makes it work, too. And it also gives you a little bit of a backstory to Lou Harper, which is necessary in this kind of narrative. It can't just be about what's happening right now. It's got to be about who he is, who he was, and who he wants to be. And you do get that from this film. Now, I'm going to play another little bit, which is a little bite from Lou Harper, where the ingenue, played by Pamela Tiffin, is trying to seduce him in a really crazy looking astrology room that her father has set up at the top of a mountain. So I'll just play that to give you a little bit of an idea of how the script shows that Lou Harper has a past.
Harper.
What?
You work hard, you know that?
Yep, regular beaver.
Harper. Don't you ever feel the need to relax? Let's relax somehow.
For what? So the beauty in the next room's gonna get all hot and bothered? Lady, if you can't get them hot and bothered by yourself, I sure ain't gonna do it for you.
Don't you think I'm attractive?
You're young, rich, and beautiful, and my wife is divorcing me. What do you think I think?
Kind of like that bit for a very simple reason. Paul Newman, one of the things that William Goldman says about Paul Newman in Adventures of the Screen Trade is that he liked other actors to bring things up to a standard so that he looks good because the ensemble is good and the story is good and the movie is good. So it wasn't just about him individually. It was about putting together a good assembly of elements to make the film good. And one of the things that a lot of actors wouldn't do in that kind of circumstance is let that bitterness show, that little touch of bitterness where he says, "And my wife's divorcing me." That kind of darkness just hinted at in the bright, sunny, rich people playground that the film is set in. Which isn't just to say this is a talkie piece either. There are a couple of good action sequences, one in a shipyard particularly, which is kind of visceral and ugly for a movie of 1966 vintage. Now, Paul Newman did play Lou Harper again in 1975 in a movie called The Drowning Pool, which I saw years ago. I'm going to have to locate a copy of it and re-watch it now, because sometimes doing these podcasts, you get led in directions and you kind of want to complete the experience of watching this. So if you can get both Harper and The Drowning Pool, maybe watch them back-to-back to see how the characters changed over the years. Interesting thing to do sometimes with movies, and the wonderful fact that we've got such accessibility to films, an unprecedented accessibility to all sorts of films, is one of the joys of the 21st century, really, amongst other things like, you know, free Wi-Fi when you can find it, good coffee, and the fact that TV is so bad you've got to go to movies to see anything decent. So I don't have too much else to talk about Harper. At the beginning of me talking about Harper, I don't know whether I back announced it or not, but that music I played just before I started talking about that movie is part of Johnny Mandel's opening main title thing to the movie Harper. And Johnny Mandel, I like his music a lot. It's very 60s. It's got that kind of 60s poppy feel. He wasn't arranged for Sinatra and a few other people in Vegas and things like that, so it's got that kind of vibe about it. But I do like his soundtracks when I find them, and they're always distinctive with that kind of light, brassy sound to them. You've probably seen the film. If you haven't, do so. As Murder, My Sweet kind of kick-started a certain kind of detective movie in the 1940s, which went on to The Big Sleep and all of those kind of things. Though maybe The Maltese Falcon really started it 3 years before Murder, My Sweet, but it was part of the resurgence in detective and crime narrative in film in the 1940s. Harper kind of started a few different things and probably led on to things like The Rockford Files on TV in the 1970s. You can kind of draw a line between Harper and Harry O with David Janssen and The Rockford Files and that kind of California sunny detective narrative kind of genre of private eye movies. So I'm going to take another break now and talk about the third film, The Long Goodbye, starring Elliot Gould and directed by Robert Altman.
Things just don't turn out the way we plan them, do they?
You were hired by a bitch to find scum.
Yeah, and every time I hope it's going to be Prince Charming sending me out to scout out Cinderella. Oh, yeah. Boy, I had a total of about 8 pretty disgusting months last year. Then I had 5 or 6 good weeks. Let me tell you something. I mean, that's something that you won't understand, and Susan sure as hell won't, but those 5 or 6 weeks, I really felt alive. So all I can do, Albert, is just do the dirty job all the way down the line.
Okay, on to 1971's The Long Goodbye. Riddle me this, Batman. What do these movies have in common? The Big Sleep, Hatari, Rio Bravo, The Empire Strikes Back, and The Long Goodbye. So you've got 2 great private eye movies, A Cowboy in Africa adventure, one of the 3 or 4 best westerns in history, and the best of George Lucas's Star Wars flicks, which isn't saying very much. Now don't go hitting IMDb or Wikipedia because I'm going to tell you. The same woman wrote all the screenplays, Lee Brackett. She was a popular and well-regarded science fiction writer in the 40s and 50s. Her short story, Shamblow, is considered a classic of the genre. She also wrote hardball detective novels. Howard Hawks roped her in to help William Faulkner, who was struggling with both the booze and the script for The Big Sleep. Hawks hired her because he read one of her crime novels and thought she was a guy. But it turned out she wasn't, and she actually helped write The Big Sleep, the script at least. Now, there are a lot of people who criticise The Long Goodbye, and they forget that Brackett had worked on a previous adaptation of a Raymond Chandler, Philip Marlowe detective story, and she had that background in hard-boiled crime novels as well. She knew the genre, she knew what she and Robert Altman were doing when they deconstructed the private eye narrative with Elliot Gould's passive iteration of Philip Marlowe, well, at least seemingly passive, he wasn't really passive. The 70s weren't the 1940s any more than the 2000s were 1971. There were changes in the world, in crime, in social belief systems, in the sunny sleaze of Southern California. It was kind of like, from the 40s to the 70s, was kind of like, goodbye Hepcats, hello hippies, goodbye muggles, hello cocaine. The movie starts with a 1940s version of Hooray for Hollywood on the soundtrack. This is a little weird that it starts out with Hooray for Hollywood because there's nothing really Hollywood about the story of The Long Goodbye, apart from the fact that a lot of it is set in Malibu, but there's nothing about Hollywood as an industry town or anything to do with the song Hooray for Hollywood in the movie. Basically, the story is late one night, Philip Marlowe has a friend, Terry Lennox, who asks him for a lift from Los Angeles to the Mexican border, Tijuana. Being old friends, Marlowe obliges and then comes back to L.A. and finds out that Terry Lennox has killed his wife and Marlo therefore is an accomplice after the fact. And he gets involved with, and he also finds out that, of course, Lennox has stolen a large amount of money from a gangster called Marty Augustine, played by the film director Mark Rydell. He also is hired to find the missing husband of a woman called Wade, a writer called Roger Wade, who's disappeared on a drinking binge, and she wants to get him back, of course. So the Hooray for Hollywood thing, I don't know whether it's Altman just having a dig at the Hollywood system, because the song actually tops and tails the movie. It appears at the beginning and the end. On to Elliot Gould as Philip Marlowe. Gould had just been very successful in MASH with Donald Sutherland and was kind of riding high. And he is slightly an odd choice for Philip Marlowe. They're deconstructing the Private Eye narrative to an extent. And Gould plays Marlowe as a seemingly passive person. He gets pushed around by all sorts of people. He goes out to get... First off, he gets pushed around by his cat. He's run out of cat food and his cat's hungry, so he has to go out to the all-night supermarket to get his cat some food. And on the way out, he meets the hippie chicks who live across the way from his penthouse. And they get him to get some brownie mix for them because they're going to make up some hash brownies. Now, they're crazy girls. They're into new yoga and they run a candle shop in Los Angeles. So that's just a side issue. But it's pretty much Altman saying that Los Angeles is a crazy place. And first off, you know, he's hassled by his cat, he's hassled by the cops, he's hassled by Marty Augustine, he's hassled by Roger Wade in a way. I mean, they get on well when he does find the missing writer. They get on well and they have a long sequence in his beach house, which was actually filmed at Robert Altman's beach house in Malibu, where they sit around drinking and there's some improvised dialogue. There's a bit of improvised dialogue in this film, which kind of goes against the grain of a Private Eye narrative. Normally, the script and the plotting is incredibly meticulous in a Private Eye narrative. You've got to have all of the pieces put together so that the detective can save the day and find out how things are going and what the truth is behind the lies and the subterfuge. The improvised dialogue, it looks a lot, it pads the movie in a way that Altman's great with dialogue and he's great with actors and things like that, but I'm not too sure about deconstructing a Private Eye movie in this kind of way is anything but a self-indulgent move. There are a lot of bits I like in this movie. There's an incredible scene of violence against a woman which comes right out of the blue, and if you haven't seen it before, we'll shock the shit out of you. There's lots of other little bits and pieces, like there's one of the heavies Marty Augustine has is Arnold Schwarzenegger. Doesn't get a word of dialogue, but he does take off his shirt, and you get the idea that he was destined for nothing. I mean, a big muscly guy with a lumpy face and a lumpy torso doing bit parts in Robert Altman movies. One of the other things is that at one stage during the film, Elliot Gould's character threatens to sick Ronald Reagan, who was then Californian governor, onto somebody. And of course, a future governor of California is one of the bit players in the film. So there are lots of weird little narrative chunks like that. I don't think this particularly works well as a detective story for the most part. There are bits of it that do, particularly the ending and some of the bits with the cops interrogating him and that kind of thing. They kind of do lip service to the Private Eye genre. But I'm not convinced to what degree this can be considered a real Private Eye movie. It's more a meditation on Los Angeles for Robert Altman. Maybe he's taken that thing. One of the good things about a good detective novel is that it's about the place where it takes place. But I think Altman's erred in the fact that he makes it mostly about the place and less about the characters and the plot and the questions that arise from them. I mean, there are some other good characters in there. There's always a good ensemble in a Robert Altman movie. You got Henry Gibson playing a dodgy doctor. You've got Sterling Hayden playing Roger Wade, the missing writer. You've got Nealon Van Pallant playing his wife, Ellen Wade. You've got Gould, of course, shambling around and somehow finding his way through the plot to a resolution, which kind of is an epiphany for all the shambling and for all the seeming passivity and the clownishness of this particular Philip Marlowe. Eventually, the moral compass straightens out at the end of the film, and the right thing is done in quite a brutal and unexpected way. But I think that Altman, in deconstructing this film, really kind of doesn't get detective narrative. He doesn't understand it. I mean, there are any number of things you can do with it. There are any number of ways to rewrite it, to rejig it, and things like that. But I don't think that Altman really understood the genre when he was making this. He understands work direction, working with characters, working with actors, and all of those things which we know is his strength as a filmmaker. But after watching The Long Goodbye again yesterday, I'm a bit conflicted by it. I liked it more the first time I saw it than I did now, mostly because I can see the bits that don't exactly work. There are long bits of dialogue that don't push the narrative forward, but are kind of amusing as standalone pieces. But as a part of a film, maybe a bit more editing was called for in places. But there are quirky bits that keep you amused. I mean, there's a gatekeeper at the entrance to the Malibu complex. He does really bad impressions of movie stars. Wikipedia entry on The Long Goodbye says this: it's a 1970s mirror of the lifestyles and culture of Hollywood. In their genres, the novel and the film are a study of a moral and decent man cast adrift in a selfish, self-obsessed society where lives can be thrown away without a backward glance and any notion of friendship and loyalty are meaningless. Yeah, well, you know, I can see it at that level, but I'm not sure that it couldn't have been made differently better. Now, I mean, let me know if you disagree. I think that Elliot Gould overplays the passivity just a little bit. And even though you do get those sly little bits where you understand that he's a more intelligent person than he's pretending to be, that he's more assertive than he pretends to be, that he's not as whiny as he pretends to be at times. In the same way that Robert Downey Jr.'s Sherlock Holmes isn't Sherlock Holmes, as we know him, Elliot Gould's Philip Marlowe isn't Philip Marlowe. See how I brought that around from what I was talking about at the start of the podcast? Anyway, I do like a number of set pieces in this film. And I do like Altman as a director, though I'm not as in love with him as some of the people I know are. I think Shortcuts is great, not just for the fact that Julie Ann Moore has an extended scene with her min showing. But I really think that this film's kind of, it sits uncomfortably with me. I'm a big crime film buff, and I'm a big Private Eye film buff. But I'm not entirely convinced that this is a Private Eye movie. I think this is a Robert Altman film that just kind of wears a trench coat as a disguise, in a sense. But let me know what you think about that. I'm just going to play a little bit from the movie to kind of show you how Elliot Gould plays Philip Marlowe in this movie.
Your name, Marlowe?
No, my name is Sidney Jenkins.
Come on, let's go inside, Marlowe. We want to talk to you.
Oh, well, I'm looking for my cat. You
forget the goddamn cat, Marlowe. Come on.
Forget the goddamn cat. Right, I see. Okay. Now, that cat means an awful lot to me. You're telling me to forget about it. Must be something mighty important.
Sit down, Marlowe. No, it's okay. I'd rather stand. No, I don't mind sitting either. Marlowe, I'm Sergeant Green. This is Detective Dayton.
Yeah, I saw your badge. Where's his?
Where did you go last night, Marlowe?
Oh, is this where I'm supposed to say, what is all this about? And he says, shut up, I asked the questions.
Yeah, that's right, Marlowe. So just ask the questions. Where did you go last night?
Well, maybe if I knew why you wanted to know, I could remember.
You gainfully employed, Marlowe?
I don't know.
Where do you work?
Yeah, I heard you. I understand English, believe it or not. I'm a private detective. I have my own agency. Those girls are vicious. Actually, I'd take a better picture now, but your business hasn't been as good as it used to be. I'm sure you guys understand that.
Marlowe, you know a white guy by the name of Terry Lunix.
Oh, yeah? Who says I do?
His address book and that yellow bomb downstairs in your garage. So?
Marlowe, just answer the question.
You want to know what I did last night?
Mm-hmm.
Well, my cat woke me up in the middle of the night. He was really hungry. So I went in to fix him his favorite kind of cat food, curry bran. You know, it's the only kind he eats. And I was out of it. So I picked something else up, and the cat clawed the hell out of me. Just wouldn't touch it. So I went out to the Thrifty Mart, you know, it's open 24 hours, to get some curry bran cat food. And they were out of curry bran cat food. Son of a bitch.
So you get what I mean about the meandering narrative there, just the way they kind of, it's got that improvised feel, which is one of the hallmarks of Altman, but not sure it belongs in a detective movie. So do let me know what you think about that, and I probably need to finish this up now. It's getting around time for dinner. It's well over 100 degrees outside. The pavement's rippling out the window, and I should tie this up. So I'll get Sal to do the contact details, and just say thanks for listening. We're back again in 3 weeks' time with the Listener's Choice podcast, featuring Walkabout, Night of the Hunter, and White Sullivan's Travels. So that's about it. Enjoy your movie viewing. Drop me a line, and I will catch you guys later.
Paleo Cinema is a 3-weekly podcast that looks at film noir, horror, cult movies, classic films, science fiction, and other genre works from 1895 to 1980. The email address is cultguru@gmail.com, cultguru@gmail.com. So please send comments, feedback, and MP3 voicemails to that address. The blog for the podcast, which has lots of extra content relating to each episode, is paleo-cinema.blogspot.com. This podcast contains adult content and occasional swearing, so don't lend your MP3 player to children.